Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Unlocking your sleep potential. Brought to you by cleanmybed.com.
So welcome to our fifth episode in this series on sleep and sleep health and the science of sleep. And as usual, as we introduced first in our first podcast, I'm here with Dr. Jill Warner, who has a BSc in immunology and physiology and a PhD in allergy from the University of London, has worked for the National Heart and Lung Institute at the Brampton Hospital in London, the University of Southampton and the Imperial College in London, and is currently an honorary professor in pediatrics at the University of Cape Town, and has published over 100 peer reviews. And along with us today, we've got a guest, and can I say it's the husband as well? I think we can say that. But you can imagine this household is very healthy when it comes to allergies. But Professor John Warner, Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics at the Imperial College in London, and also the Honorary Professor at the University of Cape Town. Welcome to both of you. Now, this is obviously one of the key subjects when it comes to sleep, allergies, and how they affect our day-to-day living. So let's just kick off with a kind of a broad look at how allergies affect sleep. I mean, why do they affect sleep? Why can't you just sleep through an allergy?
Well, when you think about it, Mike, you are sleeping in an environment that is absolutely full of the particles that actually cause the allergy. So getting into a bed is one of the most dangerous things you can do if you're an allergy sufferer. Do you know that as far as house dust mites are concerned, which are the major trigger of allergies and asthma in children, you can have up to 2 million of them living in your mattress at any one time.
Yeah.
And house dust mites are delightful creatures.
I was going to say, what are they?
Yeah, they are actually related to spiders. And they like to live in an environment very much the same as we do. If they could choose, they would live at around 25 degrees C, around 80% humidity, because they're little creatures that don't drink. They absorb water through their skin. And they are absolutely delightful. Their favourite food is human skin scales.
Right.
And, you know, we shed about a couple of grams of skin scales into our bed every single night. So these little mites are sitting there in our mattress, eating our skin scales, absorbing any sweat that's coming from our bodies into our mattresses, and absolutely loving the heat that the bodies create whilst they're in the bed.
Sure.
And then, of course, house dust mites have to have an excretion as well. So their fecal particles, their poo, is exactly what we are breathing in when we jump around in our beds. They come up into the air and we breathe them in, and it is those that people are actually allergic to.
So it's actually not the dust mite, it's the poop of the dust mite itself.
It's the components of the poo that people are breathing in that get into their airways and actually cause the allergic reactions.
So what is in that excrement of those things that causes that sort of allergic reaction? In other words, is everybody allergic to dust mites, or are some of us not?
No, it's a particular protein that is excreted by the house dust mite, and people can be allergic to different proteins in the fecal particles. There are various of them, but there is one very important one that the majority of people will be allergic to. If people are interested in the actual name of the house dust mite, the one that I've worked with the most is called a Dermatophagoides terenicinus.
Oh,
sounds like a dinosaur,
that.
Doesn't it? It's a tiny dinosaur.
Yeah.
But its allergen is called DERP1, and this is the protein in the poo from the house dust mites that gets into the airways and causes the allergic reactions.
It's actually a digestive enzyme from the bowel of the house mites. And because it's an enzyme, it can be quite irritating when it lands on the airways. Mm. And that is the process that induces the allergy in the first place.
So, I mean, are all dust mites created equal? In other words, are they different in South Africa versus the UK versus the US? Are they different brands or versions of them?
There are different brands, yes. Yeah. Yes. And you do find different ones in different areas. So very much depending on where you come from in the world, you may react to one type more than another. And they, because they like a particular environment, you will find them more in one environment than another, yes.
And going back to my first question, are we all allergic to the dust mite, or are some people immune to it?
No, you're only going to be allergic to the dust mite if you have an allergic tendency.
Right.
So for people who have no allergic conditions, the house dust mite poo really doesn't do them any harm whatsoever. Mm. It could be something else in their beds that they're reacting to, like if you let your cat sit on the bed, for example, the cat allergen gets in there as well. But no, not everybody is allergic to house dust mites. It will depend on whether you are an allergic person.
Mm. So you've just touched on my next question. Is we talked about dust mites. What other allergens are that people are allergic to when it comes to sleeping? Mm.
Yes, I mean, the indoor environment, there are lots of potential sources of allergy triggers. So animals, obviously, cats and dogs. Certainly when you speak to your patients and we ask about the animals in their house, particularly if we've already told them that they are allergic to one of the animals, and you say to them, well, do you let your cat or dog sit on the bed, and they go, oh, no, the cats, they're always kept into one room or another, they're never allowed into the bedroom. And then the small child sitting beside them will go, but mummy, the cat was on the bed this morning. And very hard to keep them off, actually.
Yeah, it's a perception, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. So cat allergen is actually one of the most important allergens, like the house dust mite, because cat allergen is on very, very tiny particles. And it comes from both sides of the cat. It comes from the sebaceous glands in the skin and from the saliva when they're licking themselves, which then dries on the fur. And you can imagine when you stroke a cat, then this cloud of particles goes up into the air. And if your cat's been sitting on your bed, it also goes down into the mattresses and the pillows. But the allergen is so tiny that it stays in the air. So you can go into a house that has had a cat 5 years after that cat has gone and still measure cat allergen in that house.
Wow.
I mean, stuck to the walls, in the carpet, unless they've been majorly cleaned, it will still be there.
Wow, I'm allergic to cats. We've kind of had to live with it because we have a cat in the family. So when you're talking about cat allergens, it's not actually the hair of the cat, it's the sebaceous, in other words, it's the sweat or the fluid of the cat that's causing the problem.
It's another protein.
Okay.
I mean, they're largely allergens are proteins, and these proteins are the size that our immune response recognizes.
Mm.
And in people who are not allergic, it will recognize it but go, oh, that's not a problem. But in somebody who is allergic, the immune system will look at it and go, ooh, this is dangerous. I need to do something about it. And then produces the antibodies and the cells that cause the allergic reactions that we see.
Yeah. Are cats, you mentioned that cats have got a particular problem. In other words, are cats the worst potential pet allergens that you get in the household? I mean, dogs less allergic, likely?
Dogs cause less allergy than cats do, yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do. And that's, again, because of the size of the particle on which the allergens are carried. So if the particles drop out quickly and they're not floating around in the air, they're less of a problem. But obviously, again, if we're thinking about your bed and sleep, then all of these will go into the mattress, and every time you turn over, they will come up as a cloud and you'll be breathing them.
Sure. I mean, when you talk about dogs, I mean, you get different kinds of dogs. You get dogs that have got fur and dogs that have got hair. In other words, non-allergic dogs. I mean, is it true that you get non-allergic dogs, dogs that have got hair, or are they still likely to call allergic reactions from some people?
There are differences.
Mm.
It's quite hard to say this type of dog will definitely not cause a problem.
Yeah.
But dogs that don't shed and dogs with curly, short fur, from the studies that I've done in the past, and there was a really interesting one actually in a little way sad, but still very lovely, where there was a man who was blind who needed a guide dog. And of course, guide dogs are largely Labradors or Alsatians, but they produce quite a lot of allergen. So he ended up with a standard poodle.
As a guide dog.
As a guide dog.
And poodles are less allergic.
Yeah, okay. They are less allergenic. Yes, they are. Yes.
Okay. Yes. So what other allergens? You talked about pets. What other allergens? I mean, the first thing I think about, we're doing this podcast here in Cape Town, when the fynbos is going in spring, suddenly everybody's taking hay fever tablets. I mean, is airborne allergens a big issue?
Yes, very much so. I mean, you're talking about seasonal allergens now, so obviously at certain times of year, there are large amounts of those particular allergens outside, although if you leave your windows open, obviously they're going to come inside as well. There are other indoor allergens too. There are molds and fungus, and you do find quite a lot of those, particularly in damp homes. I don't know whether, if you look at your shower, you sometimes see a bit of black around the edges. Yes. That's a particular type of mold called cladosporium, which can cause quite a lot of allergic conditions.
So that can become airborne?
Yes.
That green stuff on the wall can be airborne?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
If it dries, then it goes up into the air. And that can also cause problems, particularly, as I say, in damp environments.
So when you look at all the patients that you and John have seen over the years, is there a proportion of people who are dust mites, a proportion of people that are pets, a proportion of people that are airborne? And what is where are those proportions and who gets more of what?
Well, amongst children, house dust mite allergy comes out as the commonest in those that have nasal symptoms or asthma or even eczema, because it can affect the skin and cause inflammation in the skin. And that's something like 80% of the allergic children we see are house dust mite allergic. Wow. About 50% are cat allergic, 40% dog. Pollen allergy, tree and grass pollen allergies, somewhere approaching 50%. Mold allergies, rather less common, 15 to 20%. And then we see a lot of food allergy as well now, which has become an increasing concern, because of course food gets into the dust too, and including in the bed. People eat in bed, and if you're peanut allergic and anybody's eaten peanuts whilst in the bedroom, then the peanut dust gets into the bed, and that can become a problem.
Yeah, so we're basically surrounded to some extent. I mean, my one question is, how do you measure that? In other words, how do you know that somebody has a certain allergy? I mean, for instance, I can't imagine how you test somebody who's got a mold allergy versus somebody that's got a cat. What's the process of finding out what they're allergic to?
Okay, so it is really, really important when people consider that they may be allergic to something, that they actually go and have proper allergy tests done. And when I say proper allergy tests, I mean in an allergy clinic. I'm afraid there are a lot of tests out there that are completely bogus, like sending off your hair to a laboratory or holding an electric handle and seeing how strong you are. I mean, these tests are absolutely non-validated, no use whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So the two ways that people can be tested to see whether they have allergic antibodies to the exposures that they have in their home, one is a skin prick testing, which is where there are solutions made of the things that you might be allergic to, and you put little dots of those solutions on somebody's arm or on their back, and you just very, very lightly prick that into the skin, and if someone is allergic to that, it will come up as a red bump, and that will show that bump. Considering how big it becomes and how important it is, then it will tell you whether or not you're actually allergic to that particular allergen. I would have to say it's terribly, terribly important that you link that test to a history, a clinical history, so you can get false positives. So you can get a red bump, but if you ask the person, do they have any problem with that allergen, they'll say none whatsoever. So you take the history and then you do the test. So that's why it needs to be done in a hospital or a clinic environment. The other way is a blood test. So you can actually do that. And there are specific tests that, again, can look for individual allergens from individual sources that will tell you whether or not you're reacting to that.
John, you want to say something?
I think the key is for people to understand, never just do tests. The tests always have to be interpreted in the light of the person's environment, their exposures, and what problems they have. And so they must be interpreted by someone who's an expert in understanding the meaning of tests. No tests are 100%. There are false positives and false negatives. And the clinician who's dealing with the person must understand that and be able to interpret the results appropriately in order to declare whether somebody really has a problem or not. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very simple thing to do. Requires some expertise, and people should be urged not to send away tests on their own. They should go and see an allergist if they think they have an allergic problem.
I was going to say, who do you see? So an allergist is probably the best person to see because they specialise in this area.
Yes.
You don't think your GP wouldn't be the right person in this situation?
Well, some GPs have special additional training, and indeed Jill ran a very important postgraduate course training doctors from all sorts of disciplines in allergy. And so there are now some very well-trained GPs, but you have to know that they've received that extra training.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine it's quite complex trying to figure out what allergens there are, because, for instance, if you live in the UK, there are different airborne allergens versus here in Cape Town. If there's a mold, there's obviously different types of mold. And we've even talked about the fact that the dust mites have different versions of themselves around the world. So you've got to test for the local environment to some extent, don't you?
Incredibly important.
Yeah.
There's no point in running a batch of tests to things that aren't actually in the environment in which you're living. So yes, it is incredibly important to work out what is the person likely to be exposed to before actually running those tests. Yes.
In fact, there's a lovely allergist in Cape Town. He's now retired, Professor Paul Potter, who wrote articles saying, look in your own backyard to understand what people are going to be allergic to.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose in Cape Town, when we see the spring season happening, we know, I'd imagine all the GPs locally will know there's going to be a lot of people coming in with hay fever purely because of that. So why not just take an antihistamine? Why not just say, well, does all these allergies exist and I'm getting a bit of a snotty nose or I'm struggling to sleep because of these allergies? Why not just take an allergics and that's all good?
Which you can do. Of course you can. But it's going to be far, far more effective to avoid the triggers in the first place rather than having to continuously take medications. And of course people forget to take their medications and then you end up with that snotty nose again or that breathlessness. Much, much more important once you have been diagnosed with a particular allergy to find out whether or not you can avoid that allergen or remove that allergen from the environment that you're working in. Yeah.
So, I mean, is there any long-term problems taking an antihistamine for an extended period of time? Other than
provided you're taking one of the what are known as second and third generation antihistamines that have very much less effect in causing drowsiness. But all the antihistamines that people most commonly go for and that are available over the counter sometimes do have a sedative effect, and that can affect their performance by day. But there are antihistamines like cetirizine, for instance, and loratadine, which are non-sedating in doses, which can control a lot of the symptoms of hay fever. They reduce runny nose and sneezing and itchy nose and itchy eyes and itchy skin. They don't get rid of the nasal blockage, and for that you need nasal sprays.
Mm. And suddenly using steroid sprays and that sort of thing, which obviously aren't great.
Well, the steroid sprays for the nose and indeed for the lungs with asthma only work where they land within the airway, and any that is absorbed into the circulation is taken out very rapidly by the liver and therefore has very minimal effects on the rest of the body. So they're intrinsically very safe and can be used continuously, but under supervision, and if you can avoid the allergen, then maybe you won't need it, and that's obviously the best solution.
I'm interested, if somebody comes to see you and they think they're suffering from allergy related issues, what's the sort of, in other words, if somebody's listening to this podcast going, I don't know whether I'm just got a cold all the time or suffering from allergies, what are the sort of markers that you can put down to say, oh, this is definitely an allergic reaction to something?
Well, it's you've got to look for reproducibility. Does it always happen if you're in the same environment? Do you always have that same reaction? Because if it's only once, it may not be, that it may be another component entirely. As we said, I think it's very important that if you're actually suffering and struggling on a day-to-day basis from what you think is an allergy, that you actually go and see somebody about it and find out what it is. Having done that, then of course you need the right advice as to how to avoid those allergens. But in knowing which one it is most important. There's no point in doing something if you're not actually allergic to that. I've been asked so many times by patients who have been diagnosed now with house dust mite allergy or pet allergens, well, what shall I do? What can I do in terms of changing my environment? Mm. And quite often they'll say to me, if I just do one thing, what shall I do? And the answer is going to have to be look at your bed, because as we started this podcast, the bed is absolutely chock-a-block full of allergens. So looking at some of the techniques that you can use to reduce your exposure to what's in your bed, I would say if that's all you can do,
try that.
And there are various ways. There are covers for beds that actually encase the mattress so that the allergen doesn't come out. The only slight problem with that was, and there was a study I did many years ago now, where we put covers onto the mattresses and the pillows, and for the first 3 months we saw an improvement in the patients, and then they started to get worse again. The problem is that if you put a cover on top of the mattress and then just leave it there, the skin scales build up on top of the mattress and then the house dust might start again where they are. So you just get this increasing level. So whatever you do, it has to be something you do regularly. If you cover the mattress, you must clean the cover. If you vacuum the mattress, you must do it more than once in 3 years, because the house dust mite's life cycle is 2 to 3 months. So, you know, you can, if you remove as many as you can, 3 months later, if you do nothing, because you're still pushing the food for the house dust mite back into the bed, the numbers will start to increase again. So it's being regular about your treatment. So if you're using a vacuum cleaner, if you're using a sanitizing device, it is something that must be done on a regular basis to keep the allergen levels low. If you can do more, then there are other components in the house that you should look at as well.
We talked about, obviously, if you've got animals that are causing it, you've got to do something about that. But is there a way of kind of encasing the bedroom in a sort of allergic-free zone? You talked about the bed being a very effective way of doing that, but is there ways of looking at, I'd imagine carpets would be a problem, for instance, and there is not having carpets in a bedroom.
No, absolutely. And that is another area. People who are very sensitive will do better if you remove the carpets and have hard floors, which are easier to clean. Mm. For children, don't have a bed full of soft toys, because the house dust mites live in the soft toys as well.
For sure.
You can treat the soft toys, but putting them in the washing machine at 60 degrees C and then freezing them means the soft toy doesn't last too long. And if it's a very favourite one, it could be a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
Better to have something that is not so equally friendly to house dust mites and cat and dog allergies.
But soft toys are a reality. So that you just mentioned that treatment, is that a way of killing a dust mite within
a
soft toy?
The washing machine has to be at least 60 degrees C. As a wash.
Okay.
And then once you've dried them, if you freeze them and then you vacuum them, then everything should have gone from them.
And but obviously you've got to do that fairly regularly as well with the favourite one.
Yeah. Which is every 3 months.
So Pokey's gonna get washed a lot.
I think you might need a range of them that can keep replacing as you go
but
through.
They always have a favourite one, I know.
They always have a favourite one, they do. It's quite important when mentioning the bed to talk about not just the mattress, pillows and duvets. Also full of house dust mites and house dust mite allergen, cat and dog allergens as well. So if you've the duvet you can quite often put in a washing machine or take it somewhere to be cleaned. Pillows also, or again, make sure that the treatment you're giving the mattress, you do to the pillow as well.
And does the same apply in terms of washing the laundry there, in terms of the temperature that you need to wash? So you should actually be washing your sheets at 60 degrees, but you won't put them in the freezer. Practically, you're not going to do that.
No, because the freezer is actually killing anything that still remains. You're not most likely going to have live house dust mites sitting on a sheet.
Right.
They will get washed off in the washing machine. But something that is more dense, you need to be able to kill anything that's still inside it. Yes.
So what's the protocol for somebody that comes in to see you and says, right, you've identified it's a dust mite, for instance. What's their homework now? What do you give them to? John, maybe you can give us a bit of homework here.
I mean, one has to take account for the living circumstances of the people, because some people it's going to be impossible for them to achieve a great deal. I mean, in terms of their financial status, what's the quality of the living conditions? And, you know, if you start saying, well, what you should be doing is having high efficiency vacuum cleaners with special filters and bed covers and changing the humidity, that has a cost attached to it, unfortunately. Sometimes we have to just resort to medications rather than making too much of a thing about changing the environment, because that's going to cause guilt and upset and worry. Yeah. And so we have to balance things when we're making our recommendations. But there are some very good things. I mean, if you can have a very high efficiency ventilation system with heat exchanging in your house, that can make a difference. Jill did a trial of that in the past.
Explain that. What was that? What do you mean by that?
Basically, it's a system. It's sort of a very big air conditioning system that goes in the roof of the house, and it takes in the warm, humid air and replaces it with cooler, drier air. And house dust mites, as I've said, they absorb water through their skin. If you create a dry environment, which is, shall we say, less than 40% humidity, they shrivel up and die. So this works really, really well. If you look at humidity in homes, most of them are sitting around at least 60%, at least. But if you can get it down to 45 or 40, the number of house dust mites disappear fairly rapidly because they just can't survive in those environments.
So in other words, do drier regions then have less likelihood of... Okay.
Yes,
but then again, they have then airborne issues with
different ones.
And also, as John's saying, you've got to talk to your patients about what they're prepared to do. I mean, you can give them a whole list of you must do this, this, and this. You must vacuum every day. You must change the bed covers. You must wash them at 60 degrees. You must do. People have busy lives. I'm very, very aware of that. There was a wonderful study I did with high efficiency vacuum cleaners, where I'm afraid rather surreptitiously we put timers in the vacuum cleaners, and we told them they must vacuum the bedroom every day and they must do the living room every other day. And they did this over a period of a year, and we measured the dust and what allergens were in that dust over that time period. And when we took the timers out of the vacuum cleaners at the end of the year, one of the ladies had managed to vacuum for 80 hours during that time period, and somebody had only managed 2. Okay. And you can imagine the difference in the houses. So you have to take into account human nature. ask the patients, ask the person, are you prepared to do this? Because if you're not, and if you haven't got time, it's not going to work. However good the machine is, or however useful the cleaning system is, if it isn't done regularly, it won't work.
And the scary thing is, I've had somebody come in and clean the bed and hoover it and use those high power machines and clean the bed perfectly. And what's scary is what you see coming off your bed, the initial thing happens, and you think, did that come out of my bed? And you think your bed's clean. And then 3 months later, you think, well, it's only 3 months later, but there's still a lot of stuff that comes out of that bed with those high pressure vacuums. So you're right. It's not something you can do once off. Otherwise, you just build the problem back up again.
And that's a shame, because if you start to see an improvement in clinical symptoms, you want to encourage that and keep going.
So final question, obviously we're talking about sleep here. Have you seen, in other words, what do you see when you look at somebody with allergies in terms of their sleep behavior? And then how does that improve when they get the allergies under control? Is there ways of measuring that?
Yes, there are. And we've been involved with a lot of studies using what's called polysomnography. And I want some of the other podcasts are going to discuss that, where you can look at the quality of the sleep. And sleep has to go through cycles. You initially go into deep sleep, but then later on in the night and approaching the morning, you go into cycles of dream sleep, known as rapid eye movement sleep or REM sleep. And people who have allergic diseases that are disturbing them at night, whether it's just a blocked nose or actually they have asthma attacks, it totally wrecks the cycles. And so they wake up tired, their brains haven't had the kind of reconditioning that they need. And it also adversely affects the cycling of their metabolic responses, their endocrine responses, which in turn can make their allergic disease worse. Mm. And if one can get that under control at night, then all of that can be ironed out, and you improve them not only during the night, but during the day as well.
Jill, I mean, you got anything to add to that? Because that's obviously quite, I mean, that's a lot of stuff happening there. You kind of think, well, okay, you're going to get maybe not as good and nasty, but it seems to be like it affects your body quite massively.
Absolutely.
Quality of life.
And the podcast, which if people have been listening to the series, if they want to listen again, to go back to Dr. Ali Hare, she explains those different cycles of sleep and just how important they really are to quality of life and health as far as that's concerned. So all those different cycles which are affected by your allergic reactions are incredibly important to get under control. Mm. And therefore sleeping in a healthy environment that allows your sleep to be normal is very, very important, and we should do everything we can to try and maintain that.
Yeah. Well, there we go. All about allergies and sleep. Very important part of maintaining a good sleep health is making sure you get those allergies under control. Big thanks to John and Jill for joining us, and we'll be on to our next podcast. Listen up for our next one, and podcast number 6. We'll be talking a little bit about healthy sleep and your well-being around that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.